It was on the next day that Bond asked to see Vespa. He had not wanted to see her before. He was embarrassed at having to ask one or two questions about her behaviour, which mystified him. The answers would almost certainly make her out to be a fool. And he had his full report to M to think about. He didn't want to have to criticise Vespa. It might easily cost her her job. But above all, he admitted to himself, he shirked the answer to a more painful question. For an hour in that room with Le Chiffre, the certainty of impotence had been beaten into him, and a scar had been left on his mind that could only be healed by experience. From that day when Bond first met Vespa in the Hermitage Bar, he had found her desirable, and now he was afraid that his senses and his body would not respond to her sensual beauty. That was the real reason why he had put off their first meeting for over a week. He had expected that she would show some sign of her experiences, that she would look pale and even ill. He was not prepared for the tall, bronzed girl in a cream tussa frock who came happily through the door and stood smiling at him. "Good heavens, Vespa," he said with a wry gesture of welcome. "You look absolutely splendid. You must thrive on disaster." "I feel very guilty," she said, sitting down beside him. "But I've been bathing every day. I've found a wonderful stretch of sand down the coast, and I've managed to get over the fact that it's on the way down that road to the villa." Her voice faltered. The mention of the villa had made Bond's eyes flicker. She continued bravely, refusing to be defeated by Bond's lack of response. "I thought perhaps I could take you down to this beach later on. The doctor says that bathing will be very good for you." Bond grunted. "Well, God knows when I'll be able to bathe, apart from anything else." He glanced pointedly down the bed. "My body's a mass of scars and bruises. Oh, but you enjoy yourself." Vespa was stung by the bitterness and injustice in his voice. "I'm sorry," she said. "I just thought..." Suddenly her eyes filled with tears. "I'm sorry," she said in a muffled voice. "It's all my fault." She dabbed at her eyes. "I know it's all my fault." Bond at once relented. He put out a bandaged hand and laid it on her knee. "It's all right, Vespa. I'm sorry I was so rough. It's just that I was jealous of you in the sunshine while I'm stuck here. Directly I'm well enough, you must show me your beach." Bond looked at her tenderly. Like all harsh, cold men, he was easily tipped over into sentiment. Vespa put out a hand and touched one of his. Her eyes filled with tears. "It's horrible," she said. "The things they did to you. And it was all my fault." "That's all right," said Bond comfortingly. "Now come on, let's forget about it." Vespa looked at him gratefully through her tears.
"You really promise?" she asked. "I thought you would never forgive me. I'll try and make it up to you. Somehow."
She was smiling at him. He smiled back. "You better look out," he said. "I may hold you to that." From that day, Bond's recovery was rapid. He sat up in bed and wrote his report to M. He made light of what he still considered amateurish behaviour on the part of Vespa. Every day Vespa came to see him, and he looked forward to these visits with excitement. He found he could speak to her easily, and he was surprised. With most women, his manner was a mixture of taciturnity and passion. But in the dull room and the boredom of his treatment, her presence was each day an oasis of pleasure, something to look forward to. With enjoyable steps, Bond recovered. He was allowed up, then he was allowed to sit in the garden, then he could go for a short walk, then for a long drive. And then the afternoon came when the doctor pronounced him well again. His clothes were brought round by Vespa. Farewells were exchanged with the nurses, and a hired car drove them away. It was 3 weeks from the day when he had been on the edge of death. And now it was July, and the hot summer shimmered down the coast and out to sea. Bond clasped the moment to him. Their destination was to be a surprise for him, and Vesper insisted on being mysterious about it. Their drive was spoiled by a curious incident. While they followed the coast road in the direction of Le Chiffre's villa, Bond described to her his wild chase in the Bentley, finally pointing out the curve he had taken before the crash, and the exact place where the vicious carpet of spikes had been laid. But all the time she was distray and fidgety, and commented only in monosyllables. Once or twice he caught her glancing in the driving mirror. Finally he took her hand. "Something's on your mind, Vesper," he said. She gave him a taut, bright smile.
"It's nothing. Absolutely nothing. I had a silly idea we were being followed."
Under cover of a short laugh, she looked back again.
"Look."
There was an edge of panic in her voice. Obediently, Bond turned his head. Sure enough, a quarter of a mile away, a black saloon was coming after them at a good pace. Bond laughed.
"We can't be the only people using this road," he said.
"It's a middle-aged commercial traveller. He's probably thinking of his lunch and his mistress in Paris. Really, Vesper, you mustn't think evil of the innocent."
"I expect you're right," she said nervously.
She shook herself slightly.
"Now, we'll be there in a second. I do hope you're going to like it."
As they came through the dunes, they saw the sea and the modest little inn amongst the pines.
"It's not very grand, I'm afraid," said Vesper. "But it's very clean, and the food's wonderful."
She need not have worried. Bond loved the place at first sight. The low two-storied house with gay brick-red awnings over the windows and the crescent-shaped bay of blue water and golden sands. They drew up in the courtyard behind the house, and the proprietor and his wife came out to greet them. Monsieur Vessois showed them to their rooms. When the proprietor left them, Bond pushed her inside and closed the door. Then he put his hands on her shoulders and kissed her on both cheeks.
"This is heaven," he said.
And he saw that her eyes were shining. Her hands came up and rested on his forearms. He stepped right up against her, and her head went back, and her mouth opened beneath his.
"My darling," he said.
He slipped his hands down to her swelling buttocks and gripped them fiercely, pressing the centres of their bodies together. Panting, she slipped her mouth away from his, and they clung together while he rubbed his cheek against hers and felt her hard breasts pressing into him. She pushed him away and sank back, exhausted, onto the bed. For a moment, they looked at each other hungrily.
"I'm sorry, Vesper," he said. "I didn't mean to, then."
She shook her head, dumb with the storm which had passed through her. Bond put his arm round her, but she got up and walked over to the window. She stood there with her back to him.
"It's going to take some time to get ready for dinner," said Vesper, still not looking at him. "Why don't you go and bathe? I'll unpack for you."
Bond walked over to the door and looked back. She had not moved. For some reason, he thought she was crying. He took a step towards her, and then realized that there was nothing to say between them then. Bond walked along to his room and sat down on the bed. He felt weak from the passion which had swept through his body. He longed to be cooled and revived by the sea. He went over to his suitcase and took out white linen bathing trunks and a dark blue pyjama coat. As he went downstairs and passed across the front of the house, he thought of Vesper, but refrained from looking up to see if she was still standing at the window. When he was out of sight of the inn, he threw off his pyjama coat and took a short run and a quick flat dive into the small waves. The beach shelved quickly, and he kept underwater as long as he could, feeling the soft coolness all over him. Then he surfaced and brushed the hair out of his eyes. It was nearly 7, and the sun had lost much of its heat. When he came ashore, nearly a mile down the bay, he knew he had time to lie on the hard sand and dry before the tide of dusk reached him. He gazed up at the empty blue sky and thought of Vesper. His feelings for her were confused, and he was impatient with the confusion. They had been so simple. He had intended to sleep with her as soon as he could, because he desired her and also because he wanted coldly to put the repairs to his body to the final test. But somehow she had crept under his skin, and over the last 2 weeks his feelings had gradually changed. There was something enigmatic about her, which was a constant stimulus. Naked, Bond lay and tried to push away the conclusions he read in the sky. He turned his head and looked down the beach and saw that the shadows of the headland were almost reaching for him. He stood up and walked back along the beach. He slipped on the light coat and walked on to the hotel. At that moment, his mind was made up. Bond dressed in a white shirt and dark blue slacks. He was pleased when Vesper appeared in the doorway, wearing a blue linen shirt which had faded to the colour of her eyes.
"I couldn't wait. I was famished. My room's over the kitchen, and I've been tortured by the wonderful smells."
She took his hand, and together they went downstairs and out onto the terrace. Champagne stood on a plated wine cooler beside their table, and Bond poured out 2 full glasses. They looked at each other and drank deeply, and Bond filled their glasses again to the rim. All through the meal they left unspoken their feelings for each other. But in Vesper's eyes, as much as in Bond's, there was excited anticipation of the night. When the lobster had come and gone and the second bottle of champagne was half empty, Vesper gave a deep sigh of contentment.
"I've never been so spoiled before."
She gazed across the terrace at the moonlit bay.
"I wish I deserved it."
Her voice had a wry undertone.
"What do you mean?" asked Bond, surprised.
"Oh, I don't know. I suppose people get what they deserve, so perhaps I do deserve it."
Suddenly she gave a happy laugh. "Don't look so worried." She took a sip of champagne. The small shadow had passed. It quickly dissolved as warmth and intimacy enclosed them again. When they had had their coffee, Vesper came and stood behind him.
"I'm tired," she said.
She bent down and lightly brushed his hair with her lips. Then she was gone, and a few seconds later the light came on in her room. Bond smoked and waited until it had gone out. Then he followed her, pausing only to say good night to the proprietor and his wife and thank them for the dinner. It was only 9:30 when he stepped into her room from the bathroom and closed the door behind him. The moonlight shone through the half-closed shutters and lapped at the secret shadows in the snow of her body on the broad bed. Bond awoke in his own room at dawn. He got quietly out of bed and crept past Vesper's door and out of the house to the beach. For a time he swam and drifted, and then when the sun seemed hot enough, he came into the beach and lay on his back and revelled in the body which the night had given back to him. As on the evening before, he stared up into the empty sky and saw the same answer there. That day he would ask Vesper to marry him. As he walked quietly from the terrace into the half-darkness of the still-shuttered dining room, he was surprised to see Vesper emerge from the glass-fronted telephone booth near the front door and softly turn up the stairs towards their rooms.
"Vesper," he called, thinking she must have had some urgent message which might concern them both.
She turned quickly, a hand up to her mouth. For a moment longer than necessary, she stared at him, her eyes wide.
"Oh," she said breathlessly, "you made me jump. It was only, I was just telephoning to Mattis, she repeated. "I wondered if you could get me another frock, you know, from that girlfriend I told you about, the Vendeurs. You see..."
She talked quickly, her words coming out in a persuasive jumble.
"I've really got nothing to wear. Oh, is the water nice? Have you bathed? You ought to have waited for me."
"It's wonderful," said Bond, deciding to relieve her mind, though irritated with her obvious guilt over this childish mystery. "You must go in, and we'll have breakfast on the terrace.
I'm ravenous. I'm sorry I made you jump. He put his arm round her, but she disengaged herself and moved quickly on up the stairs. That was the end of the integrity of their love. It seemed fantastic to Bond that human relationships could collapse into dust overnight, and he searched his mind again and again for a reason. He felt that Vespa was just as horrified as he was. At luncheon that day, things got worse. Directly they sat down, he apologized gaily for having startled her at the telephone booth, but Vespa avoided Bond's eyes. All of a sudden, her fork fell with a clatter onto the edge of her plate. She had gone as white as a sheet, and she was looking over his shoulder with terror in her face. Bond turned and saw that a man had just taken his place at a table on the opposite side of the terrace, well away from them. He seemed ordinary enough, perhaps rather somberly dressed.
"It's the man in the car," she said in a stifled voice. "The man who was following us. I know it is."
Bond looked again over his shoulder. The man seemed to realize that he was being watched. Bond noticed that he had a black patch over one eye. He turned back to Vespa. "Really, darling, he looks very innocent." He tried to reason with her, but she paid no attention. After glancing once or twice over his shoulder with eyes that held a curious submissiveness, she said that she would spend the afternoon in her room. She walked indoors without a backward glance. A few minutes later, the man asked for the bill and left. When the patron came back, Bond casually asked about the other customer. The patron answered that the man was Swiss, a traveller in watches. He had said that he would be passing that way again in a day or two and would take another meal at the auberge. It was shocking to have only one eye. "It is indeed very sad," said Bond. Then he rose. "By the way," he said, "Madame had an early telephone call, which I must remember to pay for. Paris, an Elise number, I think," he added, remembering that that was Mattis's exchange.
"Oh, thank you, monsieur. The exchange mentioned a call to Paris. But let me see. It was an invalid number the exchange referred to."
On Sunday, the man with the black patch was back again. Bond knew it directly he looked up from his lunch and saw Vespa's face. She left her lunch in the middle and went straight to her room. He made up his mind. When he had finished, he followed her. Both her doors were locked, and when he made her let him in, he saw that she'd been sitting in the shadows by the window, watching, he presumed.
"Vespa," he said, holding her cold hands in his, "we can't go on like this. Either you must tell me what all this is about, or we must leave. At once."
She said nothing, and her hands were lifeless in his.
"My darling," he said, "won't you tell me? Do you know, that first morning, I was coming back to ask you to marry me. Can't we go back to the beginning again?"
At first she said nothing. Then a tear rolled slowly down her cheek.
"You mean you would have married me?"
Bond nodded. "Oh, my God," she said. "My God." She turned and clutched him, pressing her face against his chest. He held her closely to him. Her sobs became quieter.
"Leave me a little," she said, and a new note had come into her voice,
a note of resignation.
"I must have time to think."
That evening, most of the gayness and intimacy of their first night came back. Some of her laughter sounded brittle, but Bond was determined to fall in with her new mood.
"Give me some more champagne," she said.
She gave a queer little laugh.
"I want a lot more."
They sat and drank together until the bottle was finished. Then she got to her feet. She knocked against her chair and giggled.
"Come up quickly," she said. "I want you badly tonight."
She blew a kiss at him and was gone. For 2 hours they made slow, sweet love, in a mood of happy passion, which the day before Bond would never have thought they could regain. When he finally rose and bent to kiss her eyes and her mouth good night,
She reached out and turned on the light. "Look at me," she said, "and let me look at you." He knelt beside her. Her deep blue eyes were swimming with tears as she drew his head slowly towards her and kissed him gently on the lips. "Good night, my dearest love," she said. Bond walked to his room with a full heart. The patron burst into Bond's room holding an envelope in front of him, as if it was on fire.
"There has been a terrible accident. Madame..."
Bond hurled himself out of bed. Vesper's door was open. The sunlight through the shutters lit up the room. Only her black hair showed above the sheet, and her body under the bedclothes was straight and moulded like a stone effigy on a tomb. Bond fell on his knees beside her and drew back the sheet. She was asleep, she must be. Her eyes were closed. And yet she was so still. No movement, no pulse, no breath. That was it. There was no breath. Later, the patron came and touched him on the shoulder. He pointed at the empty glass beside her, and on the floor an empty bottle of sleeping pills. Bond rose to his feet and shook himself. The patron was holding out the letter towards him. He took it and walked blindly away. He sat on the edge of his bed and gazed out of the window at the peaceful sea. Then he turned the envelope over and opened it. After the first few words, he read quickly, the breath coming harshly through his nostrils. Then he threw the letter down on the bed, as if it had been a scorpion. "My darling James, I love you with all my heart, and I hope you still love me, because now, with these words, this is the last moment that your love will last. I am a double agent for the Russians. I was taken on a year after the war, and I have worked for them ever since. I was in love with a Pole in the RAF. Until you, I still was. After the war, he was trained by M and dropped back into Poland. They caught him, and by torturing him, they found out a lot and also about me. They came after me and told me he could live if I would work for them. He knew nothing of this, but he was allowed to write to me. The letter arrived on the 15th of each month. I couldn't bear the idea of a 15th coming round without his letter. I tried to give them as little as possible. You must believe me about this. Then it came to you. I told them you had been given this job at Royal, what your cover was, and so on. That was why they knew about you before you arrived and why they had time to put the microphones in. They suspected Le Chiffre, but they didn't know what your assignment was except that it was something to do with him. That was all I told them. Then I had to stage that kidnapping. But when I found out what had been done to you, I decided I couldn't go on. By that time, I had begun to fall in love with you. They wanted me to find out things from you while you were recovering, but I refused. I was controlled from Paris. I had to ring up an Invalide number twice a day. They threatened me, and finally they withdrew my control, and I knew my lover in Poland would have to die. But they were afraid I would talk, I suppose, and I got a final warning that Smirsch would come for me if I didn't obey them. Then I saw the man with the black patch. I knew it would be the end of our love if I told you. I realized that I could either wait to be killed by Smirsch, or I could kill myself. There it is, my darling love. It's late now, and I'm tired, and you're just through two doors. But I've got to be brave. You might save my life, but I couldn't bear the look in your dear eyes. Bond threw the letter down. Mechanically, he brushed his fingers together. Suddenly, he banged his temples with his fists and stood up. Then he cursed aloud, one harsh obscenity. His eyes were wet, and he dried them. With a set, cold face, he walked down and shut himself in the telephone booth. While he was getting through to London, he calmly reviewed the facts of Vesper's letter. They all fitted. The little shadows and question marks, which his instinct had noticed but his mind rejected, all stood out now like signposts. He saw her now only as a spy. Their love and his grief were relegated to the box room of his mind. Now he could only think of her treachery to the service. His professional mind was completely absorbed with the consequences, the covers which must have been blown over the years, the secrets which must have leaked from the centre of the very section devoted to penetrating the Soviet Union. Suddenly, Mattis's words came back to him. There are plenty of real villains. What about Smersh? How soon Mattis had been proved right. While he, Bond, had been playing Red Indians, the real enemy had been working quietly, coldly, right there at his elbow. Well, it was not too late. Here was a target for him. He would take on Smersh and hunt it down, go after the threat behind the spies, the threat that made them spy. The telephone rang and Bond snatched up the receiver. He was on to the link, the only man in London he might telephone from abroad, then only in dire necessity. This is 007 speaking. This is an open line. It's an emergency. Can you hear me? Pass this on at once. 3030 was a double. Working for Redland. Yes, damn it, I said was. The bitch is dead now.